of all time. The album received a nomination for Album of the Year at the 1985 Grammy Awards. So sorry for those of you that couldn't hear me earlier. We're looking at Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen today on By the Lyric. Again, my name is Lisa, for those of you who maybe didn't hear. But anyways, Bruce Springsteen wrote this song as well as essentially all of the songs in this catalog. From his debut album, Greetings, from Asbury Park in 1973, he was the sole writer on every song released for 20 years. It wasn't until Human Touch in 1992 that he even had a co-writer. From there, it was another 14 years before he released a song on a studio album that he didn't have a hand in writing. A collection of traditional songs on 2006's We Shall Overcome, The Seeger Sessions. So now more about the song and not just the album. Born in the USA, the song, is one of Springsteen's best-known singles. Rolling Stone ranked the song 275th on their list of the 500 greatest songs of all time, and in 2001, the RIAA's Songs of the Century placed the song 59th out of 365. Bruce's original version was recorded in 1982 for the Nebraska album, but it had a different melody. It was downbeat and somber. A straightforward fit sonically for the song's actual sad story. The upbeat-sounding version that everyone knows infuses the track with a sense of bitter sarcasm that's at the center of what makes it such a classic. It was internationally successful, reaching the top 20 in 9 countries, including the U.S. and the U.K. The song addresses the harmful effects of the Vietnam War on Americans and the treatment of Vietnam veterans upon their return home. Springsteen wrote about the problems Vietnam veterans encountered when they returned to America. Vietnam was the first war the U.S. didn't win, and while veterans of other wars received a hero's welcome, those who fought in Vietnam were mostly ignored when they returned to the States. It is an ironic retort to the indifference and hostility with which Vietnam veterans were met. A little bit of background on the Vietnam War for anyone who is not a history expert. The Vietnam War is what is also known as the Second Indochina War, and in Vietnam as the Renaissance War against America, or simply the American War, was a conflict that occurred in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia from the 1st of November 1955 to the fall of Saigon on 30th April 1975. So that's 20 years, with U.S. involvement ending in 1973. It was the second of the Indochina Wars and was officially fought between North Vietnam and the government of South Vietnam. The North Vietnamese army was supported by the Soviet Union, China, and other communist allies. The South Vietnamese army was supported by the United States, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, Thailand, and other anti-communist allies. The war is considered a Cold War-era proxy war by some U.S. perspectives. The war would have lasted approximately 19 years and would also form the Laotian Civil War as well as the Cambodian Civil War, which resulted in all three countries becoming communist states in 1975. There are several competing views on the conflict, some on the North Vietnamese and National Liberation Front side view, the struggle against U.S. forces as a colonial war and a continuation of the First Indochina War, against forces from France and later on the United States, especially in light of the failed 1954 Geneva Conference calls for elections. Other interpretations of the North Vietnamese side include viewing it as a civil war, especially in the early and later phases following the U.S. interlude between 65 and 70, as well as a war of liberation. In the perspective of some, the Provisional Revolutionary Government of the Republic of South Vietnam, which was the successor of the Viet Cong, was motivated in part by significant social changes in the post-World War II Vietnam, and had initially seen it as a revolutionary war supported by Hanoi. The pro-government side in South Vietnam viewed it as a civil war, a defense war against communism, or were motivated to fight to defend their homes and families. The U.S. government viewed its involvement in the war as a way to prevent a communist takeover in South Vietnam. This was part of the domino theory of a wider containment policy with the stated aim of stopping the spread of communism, which I think is a great aim and should be continued today. Beginning in 1950, American military advisors arrived in what was then French Indochina. Most of the funding for the French war effort was provided by the U.S. The Viet Cong, which is also known as Front National de Libération du Sud Vietnam, or NLF, the National Liberation Front, is a South Vietnamese communist common front aided by the North, fought a guerrilla war against anti-communist forces in the region, while the People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN, also known as the North Vietnamese Army or the NVA, engaged in more conventional warfare and had launched armed struggles from 1959 onward. U.S. involvement escalated in 1960 under President John F. Kennedy, with troop levels gradually surging under the MAAG program from just under 1,000 in 1959 to 16,000 by 1963. So in 4 years, it jumped basically 15,000 members or fighters. By 1964, there were 23,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam, but this escalated further following the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which a U.S. destroyer was alleged to have clashed with North Vietnamese fast attack craft. In response, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution gave Lyndon B. Johnson authorization to increase U.S. military presence, deploying ground combat units for the first time and increasing troop levels to 184,000. So again, we started with under 1,000. In 4 years, increased 15,000 to get 16,000 troops. And after that Gulf of Tonkin incident, 184,000. So every year onward, there was significant buildup despite little progress, with Robert McNamara, one of the principal architects of the war, beginning to express doubts of victory by the end of 1966, which is probably a bad sign. U.S. and South Vietnamese forces relied on air superiority and overwhelming firepower to conduct search and destroy operations involving ground forces, artillery, and airstrikes. The U.S. conducted a large-scale strategic bombing campaign against North Vietnam. Following the Tet Offensive, U.S. forces began withdrawal under the Vietnamization phase, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN. Unconventional and conventional capabilities increased following a period of neglect and became modeled on heavy firepower-focused doctrines like U.S. forces. Operations crossed international borders. Bordering areas of Laos and Cambodia were used by North Vietnam as supply routes and were heavily bombed by U.S. forces. Gradual withdrawal of U.S. ground forces began as part of Vietnamization, which aimed to end American involvement in the war while transferring the task of fighting the communists to South Vietnamese themselves, and began the task of modernizing their armed forces. Morale declining significantly amongst U.S. forces during the wind-down period, and incidents of fragging, drug use, and insubordination increased, with General Creighton Abrams remarking, "I need to get this army home to save it." Again, this was a war that lasted 20 years. From 1969 onwards, the military actions of the Viet Cong insurgency decreased as the role and engagement of the PAVN grew. Initially fielding less conventional and poor weaponry, from 1970 onward, the PAVN had increasingly become merchandised and armored, capable of modernized combined arms and mobile warfare that began to widely deploy newer, untested weapons. These two sides would see significant rapid changes throughout its lifetime from the original post-colonial armies, and by mid-1970s, the ARVN became the fourth largest army, with the PAVN became the fifth largest army in the world, in two countries with a population of roughly 20 million each. Despite the Paris Peace Accord, which was signed by all parties in January of 1973, the fighting continued as both Saigon and Hanoi attempted to take territory before and after the accord. The ceasefire was broken just days after its signing. In the U.S. and Western world, a large anti-Vietnam War movement deployed as part of a larger counterculture, the largest such anti-war movement up to that point in history. The war changed the dynamics between Eastern and Western blocs, altered North-South relations, and significantly influenced the political landscape in the United States. Across much of Western Europe and the U.S., ground force intervention spurred the rise of transnational political movements and campaigning. This kind of reminds me right now of what Ukraine is going through. Again, those of you that listen probably know that I am Ukrainian. We are actually currently fighting Russian invasion, and we all know Russia is a communist country, and Ukraine actually gained independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. So here in the Vietnam War, basically the U.S. was trying to help South Vietnam fight communism. And in the situation that we have right now, from 2014 up until now, 2019, 5 years of fighting, communism. Ukraine has gone through. Ukraine has lost its own people. Its culture hasn't been developing. The political landscape is a mess. And we really need support from Western nations, from NATO nations, from the U.S., from people that are going to help us stop communism. But anyways, that's just kind of my personal attachment to maybe the song and just fighting communism in general. So what has Bruce Springsteen said about the song? In discussing the song himself, Born in the USA, he doesn't mention Vietnam specifically. However, it is about a veteran of that war. He says it's about a working class man in the midst of a spiritual crisis in which man is left lost. It's like he has nothing left to tie into society anymore. He's isolated from the government, isolated from his family, to the point where nothing makes sense. We're starting this episode by first listening to the original version of the song before we hear the released version. So here is Bruce's original version recorded in 1982 for the Nebraska album. It's downbeat and somber. Again, a straightforward fit sonically for the song's sad story. So again, that was the original version of Born in the USA, recorded by Bruce Springsteen in 1982 for the Nebraska album. And now let's have a listen to the updated, upbeat version that was actually released on the Born in the USA album. All right, welcome back. So again, that was Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA that was released on the Born in the USA album, not the original version that we listened to earlier, which was released under the Nebraska album. Personally, I like the original version better, the one that was for the Nebraska album, just because I feel like the new updated one is just a little bit too repetitive, but maybe he wrote it so that it would gain the attention of the masses and that so that his message would actually reach an audience versus, you know, kind of something more calm and somber. Okay, so usually what I do is I kind of go through the lyrics line by line and decipher them line by line, but I think in this song it makes more sense to take each verse as it is. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be reading out each verse and then kind of looking at what it means. So starting off with the first verse, it goes, "Born down in a dead man's town, the first kick I took was when I hit the ground, ended up like a dog that's been beat too much, till you spend half your life just covering up." Despite the title and tune, Springsteen warns us right off the bat, this isn't going to be a happy, simple, patriotic song. He's not just born in a dead man's town, but born down in a dead man's town. He has kicked all his life from the very first day. The beating takes its toll, and he spends his life accommodating his wounds. The despair is absolute, and the transition to the fist-bumping chorus is unmistakably ironic. Born in the USA, I was born in the USA, I was born in the USA, born in the USA is how the chorus goes. One of the people who didn't understand the true meaning of this song was conservative columnist George Will, who after attending a show published a piece on September 13th, 1984 titled "A Yankee Doodle Springsteen," in which he praised Springsteen as an exemplar of classic American values. He wrote, "I have not got a clue about Springsteen's politics, but if any, flags get waved at his concerts while he sings songs about hard times. He is no whiner, and the recitation of closed factories and other problems always seems punctuated by a grand, cheerful affirmation, born in the USA." The 1984 presidential campaign was in full stride at this time, and Will had connections to President Ronald Reagan's re-election organization. Will thought that Springsteen might endorse Reagan, not knowing that Springsteen actually didn't support him, and got the notion pushed up to high-level Reagan advisor Michael Deaver's office. Those staffers made inquiries to Springsteen management, which were politely rebuffed. 6 days later, then-President Ronald Reagan added a short homage to Springsteen during a campaign stop in Hammonton, New Jersey, by saying, "America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your heart. It rests in the message of hope in songs so many young Americans admire. New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen. And helping you make those dreams come true is what this job of mine is all about." the campaign press immediately expressed skepticism that Reagan knew anything about Springsteen and asked what his favorite Springsteen song was. Born to Run was a response from staffers. Johnny Carson then joked on The Tonight Show, "If you believe that, I've got a couple of tickets to the Mondal Ferraro inaugural ball I'd like to sell you." During a concert in Pittsburgh 3 days after that, on September 21st, 1984, Springsteen responded negatively by introducing his song Johnny 99, which is about an unemployed auto worker who turns to murder. He says, "The president was mentioning my name the other day, and I kind of got to wondering what his favorite album must have been. I don't think it was the Nebraska album. I don't think he's been listening to this one." A few days after that, presidential challenger Walter Mondale said, "Bruce Springsteen may have been that president." Sorry. Bruce Springsteen may have been born to run, but he wasn't born yesterday, and then claimed to have been endorsed by Springsteen. Again, Springsteen manager John Lindo denied any such endorsement, and the Mondale campaign issued a correction. Now, where did this Born in the USA kind of chant idea come from? The idea came from movie director Paul Schrader, aka the dude who wrote Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is a 1976 American neo-noir psychological thriller film directed by Martin Scorsese, written by Paul Schrader, and starring Robert De Niro, Jodie Foster, Sybil Shepherd, Harvey Keitel, Peter Boyle, Albert Brooks, and Leonard Harris. Set in a decaying New York City following the Vietnam War, the film tells the story of a lonely veteran working as a taxi driver who descends into insanity as he plots to assassinate both the presidential candidate for whom the woman he is infatuated with works and the pimp of an underage prostitute he befriends. It was a critical and commercial success upon release and nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. Taxi Driver won the Palme d'Or at the 1976 Cannes Film Festival. The film generated controversy upon release, mostly because of its depiction of violence and casting a 12-year-old Foster as the child prostitute. It is regularly cited by critics, film directors, and audiences alike as one of the greatest films of all time, putting that one on my to-watch list. In 2012, Sight & Sound named it the 31 best film ever in its decennial critics poll, ranked with The Godfather Part II and the 5th greatest film of all time on its director's poll. The film was considered culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant by U.S. Library of Congress and was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry in 1994. So the story of, again, this chant, Born in the USA, is in 1981, writer-director of Taxi Driver, Paul Schrader, asked Bruce Springsteen to write the title track for the movie about a blue-collar bar band. This had the working title, Born in the USA, and Springsteen came up with the song of the same name while working on a track called Vietnam. Schrader would eventually rename his film Light of Day after Springsteen, who turned down the lead role that subsequently went to Michael J. Fox, provided him with a replacement song in the form of Just Around the Corner to the Light of Day, recorded by Joan Jett. Born in the USA is often misunderstood as a patriotic anthem to the United States. Again, in 1984, Ronald Reagan used it as a campaign song, but Springsteen promptly asked the campaign to stop. Bruce Springsteen never let his music be used in ads to sell products. He once turned down $12 million from Chrysler to use this song in their ad, and instead they used The Pride Is Back by Kenny Rogers. So here is the ad just so you know what kind of sound Chrysler was going for and why Born in the USA would have been a good pick for that.
Plymouth Sundance, the unbelievable American, under $7,600. The best value of any car in its class, including the imports. Sundance, 47 standard features, front wheel drive, quality backed by a 550 protection plan. Plymouth Sundance, the unbelievable American.
The pride is back, born in America.
So The Pride Is Back, Born in America, which is very similar to Born in the USA. This line in many ways is a plea to the VA man. VA is referring to the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. So it's a plea to the VA man, his old boss, and all the others who mistreat him. It is an exclamation of frustration, pain, and suffering from someone who fought for, lost friends for, and most importantly, was simply born in the USA. He was born in the USA, but it's not home to him anymore. He's got nowhere to go. This is what makes Reagan's use of the song so viscerally wrong. Actions like his $500 million cut to the VA are precisely what led to the painful experience of abandonment and alienation this song so perfectly describes. Men like him were the ones who abandoned these brave soldiers right when they needed help the most. Welcome back. So again, this is By the Lyric, and today we are looking at Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. For those of you that are just joining us, the song is about a Vietnam War veteran and how he can't find his place in society. We've already gone through the first verse and the chorus, so now we're on to the second verse. So the second verse goes, "Got in a little hometown jam, so they put a rifle in my hand, sent me off to a foreign land, to go and kill the yellow man." The Vietnam War was also known as the Working Class War. 80% of the 2.5 million enlisted men who served in Vietnam came from working class and impoverished backgrounds. Springsteen is referring to being in financial trouble and is sent to fight in the war. However, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence that judges during the Vietnam War era would insist that a young offender enlist in the army or head to jail. On a site called Ask Metafilter, one user writes, "How did the Vietnam draft work pre-1970? I'm very close to an uncle in my family who served reluctantly in Vietnam. About 3 months ago, a different uncle who was not close to him told me a story that shook me pretty hard. He told me that it was a big family secret that my uncle had not actually been drafted into the army, but instead had enlisted to avoid jail after he got into a Springsteen-esque hometown jam. Allegedly, my uncle was in a car accident where he killed another driver or maybe a friend, and in a resulting court case, the judge said, go in the army or go to jail. My uncle telling the story was light on details because he had heard it 35 years ago from a family friend and apparently never said anything to anyone else about it." Another user responds with, "As for the jail versus enlistment practice, I have a personal friend who grew up with a very violent father, and after mostly overcoming his youth, moved into a paper wall duplex in a rough part of Pittsburgh to save money during grad school. Long story short, his neighbor was a seemingly nice couple, except when the husband drank. One night after a few drinks himself, my friend overheard the husband beating the wife, became enraged, and kicked in the door to literally beat the out of the husband. He pled guilty to assault charges, and the judge gave him time served in exchange for deferred enlistment after he graduated in the military." There is also a documentary evidence in the form of a 1972 newspaper article that talks about the Army's attempts to end the practice. The article was titled "Army Asks End of Enlist or Jail" and stated the following. "The Army said today it has had enough trouble with draftees who don't want to be in service, so the last thing it wants is volunteers pressured to join up by judges and police officials trying to do young offenders a good turn. The judge advocate for the General of the Army, Major General George S. Prue, sent a letter to Chief Justices and Attorneys General of the 50 states, asking them to use their influence to stop the age-old practice of giving young offenders the choice of jail or the Army. The practice is now forbidden by all branches of the U.S. military. The Army, Air Force, Coast Guard, and Marines have specific sections of their recruiting regulations prohibiting enlistment in lieu of jail, fines, or other legal punishment. The Navy doesn't have a regulation on the books, but recruiters will turn away such applicants. President Johnson spoke of the military's need for more boys to fight in Vietnam. He was adamant that he would get what he requested." Again, remember that from the initial under 1,000 U.S. Men that were fighting in Vietnam at the beginning of the war, the number that they had to fill was 184,000. So this makes sense that they're trying to look for people to enlist and to go fight. Okay, it's really quiet. I thought you guys would be able to hear it. But basically, the president is saying, we are determined to convince the communists that we cannot be defeated by force of arms. And so, again, he goes on to say that we need more people to fight, and we need to fight for the cause of shutting down communism and fighting for the free world. The next verse goes, "Come back home to the refinery. Hiring man said, 'Son, if it was up to me,' went down to see my VA man. He said, 'Son, don't you understand?'" Vietnam veterans, even today, struggle with finding employment after the Vietnam War. Here, the veteran bitterly characterizes the hiring man's blame-shifting, soft rejection. Unemployment among returning Vietnam vets was astronomically high, as were the rates of divorce, arrest, and suicide. These lines also shows a little bit about where Springsteen comes from. Springsteen grew up in New Jersey, a state known for its refineries. These refineries included a lot of blue-collar but well-paying jobs. These jobs were hard to get, and you usually had to know someone in order to get hired. Veterans had trouble not only finding jobs, but also finding adequate support from the VA, Veterans Affairs, and the government in general. The next verse goes, "I had a brother at Khe Sanh fighting off the Viet Cong. They're still here. He's all gone. He had a woman he loved in Saigon. I got a picture of him in her arms now." The line about the narrator's literal or figurative brother, the word is changed to buddy in some live performances, contains a minor mistake. As we learned earlier, the Vietnam War's Battle of Khe Sanh did not pit U.S. forces against the Viet Cong. Instead, they fought the North Vietnamese Army. The U.S. won, but withdrew a few months later. The battle is a stand-in for the futility of the entire war effort. Again, remember, this war was going on for 20 years. Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City, was the capital of South Vietnam, the half that Americans fought for. It was common for soldiers to fall for local women during their years in Vietnam, and these sometimes happy but often tragic love stories have inspired a lot of music. The picture is the only memento he has left. The fact that he is in her arms, reversing the stereotypical image of the lady in the big soldier's arms, hints that this isn't a photo of the couple during happier times, but a photo of the lover mourning over her soldier's corpse. It is a bellic American pietà. The Viet Cong, also known as the National Liberation Front, was a mass political organization in South Vietnam and Cambodia with its own army, the People's Liberation Armed Forces of South Vietnam, or PLAF, that fought against the United States and South Vietnamese governments during the Vietnam War. So maybe Springsteen did get it right. It was just called the Viet Cong versus the National Liberation Front, NLF. It had both guerrilla and regular army units, as well as a network of cadres who organized peasants in the territory it controlled. Many soldiers were recruited in South Vietnam, but others were attached to the People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN, the regular North Vietnamese army. During the war, communists and anti-war activists insisted the Viet Cong was an insurgency indigenous to the South, while U.S. and South Vietnamese governments portrayed the group as a tool of Han Hoa. Although the terminology distinguishes Northerners from Southerners, communist forces were under a single command structure set up in 1958. The headquarters of the Viet Cong based at Mema came to be known as Central Office for South Vietnam, or COSVN, by its MACV and the South Vietnamese counterparts, a near-mythical bamboo pentagon from which the Viet Cong's entire war effort was being directed. For nearly a decade, the fabled COSVN headquarters, which directed the entire war effort of the Viet Cong, was the target of the RVN-US war effort, and which would have collapsed the insurgency war effort. U.S. and South Vietnamese special forces sent to capture them usually were killed very quickly or returned with heavy casualties to the point that teams refused to go. Daily B-52 bombings had failed to kill any of the leadership during Operation Menu, despite flattening the entire area, as Soviet trawlers were able to forewarn COSVN, whom used the data on speed, altitude, and direction to move perpendicular and to move underground. North Vietnam established the National Liberation Front on December 20, 1960, to foment insurgency in the South. Many of the Viet Cong's core members were volunteer regroupees, Southern Viet Minh, who had resettled in the North after the Geneva Accord. Han Hoa gave the regroupees military training and sent them back to the South along the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the early 1960s. the National Liberation Front called for Southern Vietnamese to overthrow the camouflaged colonial regime of the American imperialists and to make efforts towards peaceful unification. The PLAF's best-known action was the Tet Offensive, a gigantic assault on more than 100 South Vietnamese urban centers in 1968, including an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. The offensive riveted the attention of the world's media for weeks, but also overextended the Viet Cong. Two further offensives were conducted in its wake, the Mini-Tet and August Offensive. In 1969, the Viet Cong would reestablish the Provisional Revolutionary Government of the Republic of South Vietnam, and shadow country in South Vietnam intended to represent the organization on the world stage and was immediately recognized by the communist bloc and maintained diplomatic links with many nations in the non-aligned movement. Later, communist offensives were conducted predominantly by new mechanized PAVM forces as the ability of the Viet Cong to recruit among the South Vietnamese became much more limited. The Viet Cong remained an active military and political front. The organization was dissolved in 1976 when North and South Vietnam were officially unified under a communist government. Political and military organizations of the Viet Cong was complex, with a series of well-constructed, overlapping networks, committees, and organizations, organization and structure. Material aid was primarily provided through the well-established, ingenious Ho Chi Minh Trail, which withstood the most sustained bombing campaign in history while expanding the war effort. They had further developed a complex insurgency warfare method capable of countering overwhelmingly superior numbers and technology, retaining the strategic initiative during much of the war. According to the Pentagon Papers, 90% of large firefights were initiated by the PAVN, and 80% were well-planned VC operations throughout most of the war, and as early as 1966, U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara expressed doubt about the U.S. ability to win the war. So just a little more on the Battle of Khe Sanh. So we just learned about the Viet Cong and who the Viet Cong were and what they did. Now, the Battle of Khe Sanh, which happened from the 21st of January to the 9th of July, 1968, was conducted in the Khe Sanh area of northwestern Cong Tri Province, Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, during the Vietnam War. The main U.S. forces defending Khe Sanh Combat Base, KSCB, were two regiments of U.S. Marines supported by elements from the United States Army and the United States Air Force, as well as a small number of the South Vietnamese Army, ARVN, troops. These were pitted against two to three divisional-sized elements of the North Vietnamese Army, NVA. The U.S. command in Saigon initially believed that combat operations around the Khe Sanh combat base during 1976 were part of a series of minor North Vietnamese offensives in the border regions. That appraisal was later altered when the NVA was found to be moving major forces into that area. In response, U.S. forces were built up before the NVA isolated the Marine base. Once the base came under siege, a series of actions was fought over a period of 5 months. During this time, the Khe Sanh combat base and the hilltop outposts around it were subjected to constant North Vietnamese artillery, mortar, and rocket attacks, and several infantry assaults. To support the Marine base, a massive aerial bombardment campaign called Operation Niagara was launched by the U.S. Air Force. Over 100,000 tons of bombs were dropped by the U.S. aircraft, and over 158,000 artillery rounds were fired in defense of the base. Throughout the campaign, U.S. forces used the latest technology to locate NVA forces for targeting. Additionally, the logistical effort required to support the base once it was isolated demanded the implementation of other tactical innovations to keep the Marines supplied. In March 1968, an overland relief expedition, Operation Pegasus, was launched by a combined Marine Army-South Vietnamese task force that eventually broke through the Marines at Khe Sanh. American commanders considered the defense of Khe Sanh a success. But shortly after the siege was lifted, the decision was made to dismantle the base rather than risk similar battles in the future. On the 19th of June 1968, the evacuation and destruction of the Khe Sanh combat base began. Amid heavy shelling, the Marines attempted to salvage what they could before destroying what remained as they were evacuated. Minor attacks continued before the base was officially closed on the 5th of July. Marines remained around the Hill 689, though, and fighting in the vicinity continued until the 11th of July, until they were finally withdrawn, bringing the battle to a close. In the aftermath, the North Vietnamese proclaimed a victory at Khe Sanh, while U.S. forces claimed that they had withdrawn, as the base was no longer required. Historians have observed that the Battle of Khe Sanh may have distracted American and South Vietnamese attention from the buildup of Viet Cong forces in the South before the 1968 Tet Offensive. Nevertheless, the U.S. commander during the battle, General William Westmoreland, maintained that the true intention of the Tet was to distract forces from Khe Sanh. So everyone's trying to distract everyone, and everyone's kind of trying to be tactical in this war. Anyways, love you, Bruce Springsteen, but my hour is almost up, and I still have a lot to get through. Anyways, so we just, for those of you that are just joining us, this is by The Lyric, and we are looking at Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. We've already gone through a few verses and the chorus. It's about a Vietnam war vet and how he can't find his place within U.S. society. So the next verse goes, "Down in the shadow of the penitentiary, out by the gas fires of the refinery, I'm 10 years burning down the road, nowhere to run, ain't got nowhere to go." After the Vietnam War, there were large counts of incarcerated veterans. The number of inmates in jails and prisons that were discharged from the military rose from 4% pre-Vietnam to 67% post-Vietnam. There were also a significant amount of diagnosed mental disorders, with approximately 50% of inmates that were veterans or had combat experience were told by a mental professional that they had a mental disorder. According to self-reporting of inmates, at one point, a quarter of the American prison population consisted of vets. Further studies showed that the number was vastly inflated, but the fact remains that a lot of Vietnam veterans spent time in prison that probably wouldn't have had they not been in the war. The refinery may be an allusion to the Bayway Refinery and East Jersey State Prison in Elizabeth Linden at Rahway, New Jersey, respectively. The two spots are only about 15 minutes apart, not far from Newark. Our protagonist feels that without the mindless refinery job, he'd likely end up in jail. The song was first recorded in 1982 and released in 1984, a little less than 10 years after the end of the Vietnam War, which lasted until 1975. 9 years after the war's end, he feels trapped. Nowhere to Run is possibly a reference to Springsteen's 1975 breakout album and song Born to Run. It also suggests that the protagonist can't escape his dead-end future. He needs his job after meeting so many excuses and roadblocks since coming home. Springsteen could also be giving a hat tip to Motown by referring to Nowhere to Run by Martha and the Vandellas, a song popular during the Vietnam War era. So then we have the chorus again, but it's a little bit different than just a chant of Born in the USA. This time the chorus goes, "Born in the USA, I was born in the USA. Born in the USA, I'm a long gone daddy in the USA. Born in the USA, born in the USA, born in the USA, I'm a cool rocking daddy in the USA." The end of the song features a long coda, but the engineer on that session, Toby Scott, recalled it was originally even longer. He says, "I'd gotten a good cue mix for everybody so they all could hear it, and the takes were like 10 minutes long. On the final cut, there's a rather long ride out, but it was even longer, and we cut it down by 3 or 4 minutes. The band just kept playing. There were 8 takes of the song. Take 6 was the master, thanks to Max perfecting his bass drum pattern. And when the band members came into the control room after the first couple of takes and heard the track, they too were going, 'My God, we've never heard anything like this before.' It was totally revolutionary, different sounding to anything else at that time." Long Gone Daddy is a reference to the eminent Hank Williams, a representation of the tragic Americana evoked by Springsteen's anthem. The phrase, "cool rocking daddy," is bitterly sarcastic. Unlike the global rock star singing the song, the protagonist is unknown and forgotten by his country. Here is a little clip of Long Gone Daddy by Hank Williams Sr., Jr., and III.
Whoa.
Anyway, so just a short clip of Long Gone Daddy by Hank Williams Sr., Jr., and the Third. But I think it's really interesting that Bruce chose to reference this song. So I just want to kind of explain a little bit more about who Hiram King, or Hank Williams, was. So he was born on September of 1923, and he passed away in January 1st of 1953. So 30 years old, or he lived for 30 years. So he was an American singer, songwriter, and musician. He was regarded as one of the most significant and influential American singers and songwriters of the 20th century. He recorded 35 singles, 5 released posthumously, that reached the top 10 of the Billboard Country and Western bestsellers chart, including 11 that ranked number 1, 3 that were ranked number 1 posthumously. Born in Mount Olive, Butler County, Alabama, Williams relocated to Georgiana with his family, where he met Rufus Payne, who gave him guitar lessons in exchange for meals or money. Payne had a major influence on Williams' later musical style, along with Roy Acuff and Ernest Tubb. Williams would later relocate to Montgomery, where he began his music career in 1937, when producers at radio station WSFA hired him to perform and host a 15-minute program. He formed the Drifting Cowboys backup band, which was managed by his mother, and dropped out of school to devote his time to his career. When several of his band members were conscripted into military service during World War II, Williams had trouble with the replacements, and WSFA terminated his contract because of his alcohol abuse. Williams eventually married Audrey Shepard, who was his manager for nearly a decade. After recording Never Again and Honky Tonkin' with Sterling Records, he signed a contract with MGM Records. In 1947, he released Move It On Over, which became a hit, and also joined the Louisiana Hayride radio program. 1 year later, he released a cover of Lovesick Blues, recorded at Herzog Studio in Cincinnati, which carried him into the mainstream of music. After an initial rejection, Williams joined the Grand Ole Opry. He was unable to read or notate music to any significant degree. Among the hits he wrote were Your Cheatin' Heart, Hey Good Lookin', and I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, retweet. Years of back pain, alcoholism, and prescription drug abuse severely compromised his health. In 1952, he divorced Shepard and was dismissed by the Grand Ole Opry because of his unreliability and alcohol abuse. On New Year's Day, 1953, he died suddenly, while traveling to a concert in Canton, Ohio at the age of 29. Despite his short life, Williams is one of the most celebrated and influential popular musicians of the 20th century, especially in regards to country music. Many artists covered songs Williams wrote and recorded. He influenced Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry G. Lewis, Bob Dylan, George Jones, and the Rolling Stones, among others. Williams was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1961, the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1970, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. Now, the connection that I want to make here is that we see how the tragedy of Hank's life, short-lived but with significant contribution to American society, can be compared to that of a veteran. Their enjoyable life was short, as post-war they come back with physical scars, but even stronger emotional and mental scars. And even though the contribution to the freedom of society as a whole was great, not many people realize how much they gave and what their sacrifices truly meant, just like Hank's sacrifices for his career that resulted in loneliness and a messy life. So I'm going to leave you again with the released version of Born in the USA. I thank you for joining me on this program. Again, my name is Lisa, and this is By the Lyric. We're on every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m., and I hope that you learned something today, because doing the research for this, I didn't think I would learn as much as I did. Have a great weekend.